1 billion euros from some 70 countries in immediate aid to help Ukraine get through a harsh winter. So much money was pledged that out of the 1 billion euros, 493 million euros, roughly half of it was not even designated. Meanwhile, the U.S. has just announced another batch of aid. When the U.S. Treasury Secretary was asked recently for how long will that level of U.S. support to carry on, Janet Yellen said, as long as it takes. Is that code for we want the war to continue? Isn't this money by the U.S. and EU being splurged at the expense of millions of others in their own country who are in need of health care, education, or food? Welcome to the Spotlight. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Gilbert Doctorow joins us. He's an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, I'll first start with you. Taking a look at the aid that's being pledged for Ukraine, the most recent one was the more than, first you have the more than $40 billion in additional aid to Ukraine that was approved by Congress, bringing the U.S. commitment to the Ukraine conflict of $54 billion. This was combined. Well, you know what? There's so many aid figures that I have for the U.S. that I can't even tell you. I get confused. I'm curious as to this aid that first the U.S. is pledging to Ukraine in the amounts that it is and in the frequency that it is. Is it yielding the results that the U.S. wants to see from this conflict?
I think that we're talking about Washington politics and the view in Washington, at least, you know, the establishment view is that the money is well spent, that Russia is being kept occupied. Russia is bleeding. Ukraine is still standing. And the price tag is, you know, it's humongous. I think that the total you were probably groping for was around 100 billion all told. But compared to other, other things, it's not very much. And so I think that the view in Washington is that it is a good investment. Whether or not, I think it is prolonging the war. I think Ukraine would have folded a long time ago if it weren't for all this aid, not just the arms and training and advice and intelligence help, but just cash to pay to fill out the Ukrainian budget. So I think that's what's keeping Ukraine going.
Okay, Fred Weir mentioned the figure 100 billion. Gilbert Doctorow, that is roughly the right figure. It isn't roughly. I think it is the right figure because what I have from the Kiel Institute tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries, and that was from January 24th to October 3rd of 2022, of which out of that 52.3 billion came from the U.S., 29.2 from the European Union, and 12.3. Again, in euros, from other countries, mostly from the United Kingdom. When you take a look at the money that's being pledged to Ukraine, what does that spell? Because some say, in one respect, it means the war should go on. Do you see the pledging of money to equate to that?
They're pledging what they can provide. Whether or not that is efficient, is productive, is an entirely separate question, which doesn't bother them in the least. Efficacy has gone out the window a long time ago. We are talking about political posturing here. If the West, if the United States, had what the Ukrainians need, that in terms of military support, that would be one thing. The reality is the war is being fought on Russia's terms. This war is an artillery war. And in artillery, Russians have the stores and Russians have the production capacity currently many, many times greater than the United States and its allies have to provision Ukraine. So in the area that is decisive for the outcome of this war, Russia is ahead, and all of these pledges are virtually meaningless in terms of Ukrainian military prospects. Financial aid is a different story, and I agree entirely with Fred Ware that the financial assistance from the United States and from Europe has been decisive in allowing the Ukrainian government to stand, to pay the salaries of its administrators, of its government, and its pensioners and the rest of it. But as regards military prospects, that's a wholly different situation, and you cannot give what you do not have. The Russians have it, the West does not.
Fred Weir, the news on this is contradictory and is conflicting. You have on the one hand a senior Ukrainian official saying Ukraine is running out of vital weapons, Kiev is starting to feel the shortage of what it said was anti-air capabilities. On the other hand, you have other sources like the Defense Post website stating that Russia has admitted that it may be running short on supplies. What is the story on either side?
Well, nobody really knows. I've been trying to look into this in Russia, and most of what you want to know is top secret. That's common in wartime. I think that in Ukraine, you can't get the slightest accurate figure about anything. In the West, there's a little bit more transparency, and it is clear that their stockpiles are running down. They've just poured so much into Ukraine that the military, you know, it's hard to believe that the military forces of the most powerful alliance in history are running out of basic equipment and materiel. But how imminent that is, I mean, the actual running out of ammunition, nobody knows. And in Russia, too, I think, from what I can find out, I would not underestimate the ability of Russian industry to provide what the Russian military needs. They have huge stockpiles, that's one thing. But, you know, the things you hear people saying, suggesting that maybe the Kalashnikov works can't produce enough assault rifles, or Ural wagons of odd enough tanks for the Russian army, history suggests otherwise.
Well, also there is reports indicating, Gilbert Doctorow, that the U.S. is running low on weapons. And in particular, one of their outlets from the U.S. Reported on some advanced weapons system and munitions. Does the fact that the U.S. is running low on weapons, what does that mean? And we need to take a look at this because I guess the ultimate question I'm asking is, does the longevity of the war and the duration of the war depend on the supply of weapons?
Yes and no. It depends on the Russians' strategy for proceeding. If they wanted to have the offensive that has been much talked about and which would seemingly be supported by the mobilization that took place from September, if they wanted to have a knockout blow on the ground against Ukrainian forces, that's one thing. That I can say that prospect has been dimming in the last few days, even weeks. We expected by mid-December, when the ground hardens in Ukraine from frost, that the Russians would make a move. There is nothing to suggest that that is happening now. Or there are hints coming out of the Kremlin that there may be a late spring offensive. In the meantime, what Russia is doing is a different war. It is the war of attrition. It is the destruction of the infrastructure in Ukraine, which will have the effect of depopulating further the major cities because they become uninhabitable. Here in Belgium, we're now experiencing weather on the order of zero in the daytime and -5, -6 at night. That is exactly what Kyiv is experiencing. And I can tell you, from what I see around me and from living here, it is unimaginable that one could stay in a city, at least and particularly stay in a city that has so many high-rise residential blocks, with no heating, no electricity, and no water. That is unimaginable. So it is only a question of weeks before there's a big exodus from Kyiv and other cities, Lvov, other cities that have been particularly affected by the Russians' destruction of the power generation. That is the second type of war. It is a war that is supported by drones and to a limited extent by the Air Force, though the Russian Air Force is carrying out its missions away from the Ukrainian territory. These are long-distance missiles that are being fired by Russian Air Force. So the war has peculiarities which are being dictated by the Russians as they do their own calculus on how to proceed without inviting a direct confrontation and a NATO-Russia war that escalates to nuclear. There are calculations here which are very specific to the confrontation between the world's two nuclear powers. And Mr. Putin has been very prudent and very careful, some people will say he's been overcautious, to avoid that precisely that escalation to nuclear war.
I see.
And for this, for these reasons, the calculations of what the West has by munitions, what Russia has by munitions, is missing the point. The Russians are deciding how the war is being prosecuted. And they're deciding that precisely with the intent of avoiding an escalation to nuclear.
All right. We have to take a look at what the Russian president has said there, Fred Weir, because it may indicate as to the direction of this war, where it may go. In the most recent statement regarding on weapons now, we know that Vladimir Putin has said, you know, the more you pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this war is going to take, and it's going to lead to more destruction. But he said that the West had de facto turned Ukraine into a colony and is using Ukrainians as cannon fodder and a battering ram against Russia while supplying Kyiv with weapons. Can you explain to us what that means there?
Well, I think the Russians have been saying this from the start, that they're not fighting Ukraine as such. They're fighting the United West or NATO, who are using Ukraine in this way, battering ram as an anti-Russian instrument. This is what the Russians say. And, you know, the things that NATO leaders say tends to corroborate that. For instance, Jens Stoltenberg saying a defeat for Ukraine would be a defeat for NATO. You know, that's exactly what Putin is claiming. So to some extent, and I think it remains to be figured out, calculated, this is definitely a proxy war.
Okay.
And I think that the greatest danger here is that Ukraine is going to be destroyed in the process of it.
It sure is. Well, that statement that you said there is what I need to ask you, Gilbert Doctorow. Jan Stoltenberg saying a defeat for Ukraine is a defeat for NATO. I'd like to get your reaction on that. But on the other hand, I want to also ask you whether that is a tactic that's being used not only by NATO, but maybe the U.S. pushing onto other European countries to scare them into thinking that they're next.
Well, I don't think the United States has to scare them particularly. Going back months, the way the Europeans entered on the sanctions program in hydrocarbons, committing suicide, that was already the indication that these countries were scared to death of Russia's flexing its muscles, because it revealed their powerlessness and their military shortcomings, which only could be compensated for by very active American participation in the conflict. So there's no need to look at what happened in the last several weeks. If you go back months, as I say, the Europeans all lined up like so many ducks following the United States into what is for them economic suicide, because they are were frightened by the exposure of their own military weakness before Russian strength.
The notion of peace talks has come up on a few occasions, not so often recently, Fred Weir. I'd like to get your thoughts on what Zelensky demanded, which was on the three steps. This was on December 13th. I need to make a note of that date to you. A couple of them was about sending more advanced arms and then some money. But the third one referred to a 10-step peace formula, of which at the core of it, which pretty much Russia is rejecting, is the fact that it wants Russia to relinquish all lands that, based on Kiev, considers to be under its own sovereignty. Why would he make a proposal for peace at this point, especially given the fact that he knows that Russia would outright reject one of those provisions, which is obviously the four regions that went through a referendum?
I don't think he made a proposal for peace. I think he's under some pressure, especially from Europeans, to sound more conciliatory. But what he made there was a proposal for more arms and more money for Kiev. Obviously, that's what that was about. And I don't think that there is any grounds for a negotiated, but even the opening of negotiations at this point, it clearly, the two sides are so far apart, and neither side has really stated what they want. I mean, they make these, especially Kiev makes these maximalist demands, but what would they maybe accept in certain circumstances? Because we remember back in March, they did. They were right on the verge of accepting a peace settlement. So clearly there is a...
You mean when talks were happening in Turkey at that time?
Yeah, that's right. They were derailed, but it was on the table. It was, you could practically, like there was even, I remember that weekend, there was some feeling of euphoria that maybe this thing can end. Well, not anymore. And now I think that we're going to have to see more developments on the battlefield. That something will have to change, something decisive will have to be established before there is any talk of negotiations.
Gilbert Doctorow, I can't help but ask, why is it that when either Zelensky or the U.S. President Joe Biden talks about any type of peace, it's not taken as serious as when the Russian President Vladimir Putin says that he's open to it if the four regions that went through a referendum is accepted by Ukraine and de facto perhaps the U.S.? It seems like when he's saying that he perhaps means it, or is that a wrong interpretation?
No, he means it. The Russians are prepared to go as far as necessary, meaning to the Romanian border, and the softening up of Odessa by recent attacks, air attacks, missile attacks by the Russians, is an indication of where they are headed, if need be. Will they deprive Ukraine of access to the sea? If need be, yes. But they are clearly hinting, as you just suggested, at a settlement that doesn't destroy the viability of the remaining Ukrainian state. The unacceptability of Putin's proposals to the Ukrainian side is self-evident. So in a way, what Mr. Putin was saying is as declaratory and posturing as what Mr. Zelensky was saying. Neither side is really ready for a peace at this stage when there has been no decisive military victory that they can claim. Will there be a decisive military victory? As I say, it depends very much on the Kremlin's decision how to prosecute this war further while avoiding the possibility of a nuclear escalation. If it remains where it is now, which is the inch by inch, meter by meter, kilometer by kilometer, progressive advance of Russian forces in Donetsk Oblast. After all, it was to to retake the Donbas to its pre-existing borders, which was what the first objective of the Russian special military operation. That is proceeding. If it is a question of grinding down the Ukrainian military, the reports that we receive from last week suggest that as many as 800 casualties on the Ukrainian side every day in the Donbas region, but not to mention other fronts. So the Ukrainians are running out of not just ammunition, they're running out of reserves and out of their ability to regenerate their army at the level of casualties that they are now experiencing by making their hopeless attacks on the Russian fortified positions.
All right. Since we talked a little bit about possibility of agreements or not, this made a lot of news, Fred Weir, and what the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel stated in terms of the Minsk agreements when she said, quote, the Minsk agreements were an attempt to give Ukraine time. Of course, Vladimir Putin was disappointed by what she had said, and she said, and he said that, you know, this is another case where you can't trust the West. And he said that their point was only to load up Ukraine with weapons. It's something that Russia should have seen. Do you think that that was really indeed the case? And if we're looking at the possibility of other agreements, that perhaps there's going to be this type of, sneakiness to go on?
I think that Merkel was talking. She's trying to justify herself and the choices and decisions she made in hindsight to a certain extent. But that admission that the Minsk agreements were mainly designed to give Ukraine time to strengthen, to recover from the military defeat that they did suffer in 2014-2015, that is kind of damning. The Russians are in the room listening to that, and not only them. The Serbians are listening to that. Everybody is. And the duplicity, I can't think of a more appropriate word, on display there is going to come back to haunt.
All right, a final question. You talked about deaths, and I need to get this out to get some idea on this, Gilbert Doctor. And that is what von der Leyen stated in a press conference, of which those figures were taken out, and that was 100,000 or over 20,000 civilians and 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in Ukraine. What is the deal there? You have Mark Milley, of the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chief of Staff, that said over 100,000 Russian soldiers were killed and also 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers. What kind of death count is there?
Well, for the reasons that were discussed by Fred Weir earlier, these statistics are kept under close guard in Russia, the figures that we get from Ukraine are utterly unbelievable. The notion that I hear is that the Russians are experiencing today anyway one-tenth of the casualty rate of the Ukrainians. That is plausible, in which case the range would be 10,000 or 15,000 Russian deaths and not 100,000.
Okay, we appreciate that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. Thank you, Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, and Fred Weir, thank you, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And that does for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitakhvay and the team. It's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, following the prophets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that the Quran is the book of guidance, and Allah has sent the book of guidance in the shape of Quran, and He has mentioned the stories of the prophets. And these stories are for the guidance of the mankind If someone wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must follow the guidance that is being given by the Quran. Therefore, when we look at the life of the prophets, in order to get some guidance from there, for example, in the life of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, we see that the Prophet Musa alayhi salam was the one who stood against the oppression of his time. Bani Israel, who was under the pressure and the oppression of the Pharaoh, and they couldn't go anywhere where the Pharaoh was killing their kids. He was killing the generations. He had them under the oppression. He came as a Messiah and he saved them. He was the savior of the Bani Israel of that time. And therefore, it shows us that if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, we cannot live by closing our lips and not talking not talking against the oppression. If we are silent, we are not raising our voice against the oppression, then obviously the same thing that has happened to Bani Israel at the time of Pharaoh will happen to us. And this can only be done in order to have a good lifestyle. It can only be done if we follow the footsteps of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, the way he raised his voice against the oppression, the way he came in front of the Pharaoh. And today even we see that the oppression that is going around the world, how the oppression is happening. And those who are silent, they are having more oppression. But those who raise their voice, they are living a free life. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We gave the example of the Prophet Moses alayhi salam, how he stood against the oppression and how he was acknowledged, or he knew about the time where he was living, about the things that were happening in his time. And we see that Prophet Moses, with all knowledge, has come against the oppression. And that is the duty of every single Muslim. If they want to have the Islamic lifestyle, they must be aware of what is happening around the world, the oppression that is happening. For example, we can see people in Yemen, we can see oppression in Yemen, in Palestine, we can see oppression in the West or East. There is many discriminations that are happening, many things that are against the Islamic teachings. We can see, for example, you know, the movement of LGTB. This is against the beliefs that we have. This is against the beliefs that the Prophet Moses had. Obviously, Prophet Lut was at the time of the Prophet Moses, and they were living at the same time. So the prophets in the Quran, they stood against these types of theories or thoughts. Why? Because these things are not taking us towards the perfection. The goal is to go towards the fitrah. The goal is to reach to the perfection. And the only place, only time when we can reach to perfection, or we can travel towards the perfection, is when we are aware of everything, what is right and what is wrong. And we are raising our voice against the wrong things. We should not be amongst the wrongdoers. If today the world, the secular world, or the world who is against even God, if they are having the movements against the teachings of the religion, against the teachings of Allah, for example, in the shape of LGBT movement, I don't know, in the shape of feminism, in any shape, if they are a Muslim, if he wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must aware his kids of these frauds, these things that are happening, these wrong, we can say, beliefs, and we need to save our children, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Another attempt to stoke division in Iran by terrorists who would stop at nothing to reach their goal of creating instability. On December 9th, officials in Sistan and Balochistan province said the body of slain Sunni cleric Molevi Abdulwahid Righi, who was kidnapped a day earlier, has been found. According to police reports, on Thursday, a number of unknown individuals took him away in a car that had no license plate.
He was a good person who always tried to help people. He was my student. He always supported the Islamic Republic.
He was a patriotic and religious person. Iran's unity and territorial integrity was very important to him, and he even served in the Iran-Iraq War.
Days before he was kidnapped, he met a delegation representing leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the province. Molevi Abdulwahid Righi always emphasized on the importance of allegiance to the Islamic Republic. In the province, he was seen as a symbol of unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Sistan and Balochistan province is among the regions most affected by the recent farm-backed riots in the country. And this recent assassination is an obvious attempt to stoke division. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Every product showcased carries one same tag, made in Iran, which is also the title of this exhibition. It's the 10th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products in a range of industries, from oil and petrochemical sectors to electricity, agriculture, and health.
An equipment, I know, a quadcopter, to look for example, people or survivor under the rubble, so also we can save them.
We have showcased our 3D printer today. 3D printing can manufacture parts within hours, which speeds up the prototyping process. This allows for each stage to complete faster.
I work in Saadi Foundation. We are trying to develop a Persian language through softwares, and we're trying to make people know about Iran, the truth about Iran.
The expo is a hot marketplace for local tech products, as it gives a chance to manufacturers to trade their products here. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount, funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production.
Our equipment are considered inventions, so they are not well known. Now, this expo shines a light on our products and has so far helped us find many customers.
Since the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the Iranian government still pursues diplomatic channels with the West, it capitalizes more on domestic production, as it believes this will shield the economy against foreign pressures.
Local brands here say the United States measures have given domestic production a boost in Iran. As they say, the government has made a strategic shift toward an economy that's driven by Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Press TV, Tehran.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders in many cases have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights under the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they're not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observe the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended mourning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The mourning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household, which is to be followed by their faithful followers.
Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon are among the other Muslim countries marking the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
While honoring her immense sacrifices and services in the path of Islam, participants in the ceremonies described Fatima Zahra as the best role model, not only for the Muslims, but for the followers of all religions. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The EU started out as a peace project. Some lawmakers say the bloc is becoming more authoritarian. A meeting of justice ministers on Friday heard at least €300 billion worth of Russian assets inside the EU have been frozen since March.
There are 1,359 individuals and companies on our sanctions list with assets and financial resources all over the EU. We cannot let anything slip through the net.
With even more sanctions on the way for Moscow, EU officials are now using torture analogies.
Every time that there is a need, we turn the screw further.
But at what price? The EU's energy sanctions targeting Russia are strangling the bloc's economy. Rents and mortgages are rising steadily. Young people in precarious jobs are at greatest risk.
Very, very bad. Really bad. It's like everybody knows somebody that lose a job, that lose that is their people losing houses, families losing houses.
It's quite depressing for us to think that, for example, as for me, I'm studying a degree and I'm nearly certain that I'm not going to find a job when I'm done with it.
EU social affairs ministers met here in Brussels on Friday.
Many people, many households are facing difficult moments and we should leave nobody behind.
Charities say it's already too late for many and words need to be replaced by actions. At the same time, the EU is able to send billions of euro to the Ukrainian army and government. We do not hear anything about peace negotiations. Instead, EU leaders will meet here next Thursday to agree on more funding for Ukraine's army. On the same day, the European Central Bank will announce interest rates are to go up further. Critics say that priorities are all wrong. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, a string of anti-system parties labelled by the Italian media as the Forces of Dissent gathered in Rome to discuss the challenges being faced by Italy and the EU and future strategies. The meeting was attended by political groups including More Sovereign and Popular Italy, Reclaim Italy, an alternative, formations advocating for the protection of Italy's sovereign interests and for shielding a growing number of Italians who are paying a heavy toll to what they call a dictatorship of neoliberalism.
In short, we are under a dictatorship, a regime that has stripped us all of dignity, rights. We can't get decent jobs anymore. Our constitution has been vilified. Our youngest generations have been taught the wrong values.
Independent journalists and geopolitical analysts also attended the meeting. They slammed the EU for its vulnerability to corruption and NATO for its belligerent posture. They also argued that the energy crisis was purposely triggered to favor the energy giants and their shareholders.
NATO is primarily responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. A long-planned operation, which has also involved the U.S. Secret Services since the 2014 coup in Ukraine. We believe nations should reclaim their sovereignty and be free to strengthen ties with any country they want.
This affection for politics is running wild in Italy. The turnout for last September's general elections was about 64%, the lowest ever recorded, 9% down compared to the 2018 vote.
Our party was boycotted when we ran in the elections last September. The Italian media simply ignored us. Furthermore, about 4 out of 10 Italians did not vote, meaning that the current parliament only partially represents the will of the people.
Following the outcome of Italy's latest elections held in September, which saw a right-wing coalition led by Giorgia Meloni emerging as winners, all anti-system parties have remained out of the parliament. The once anti-establishment five-star movement managed to garner 18% of the votes, but its section in the parliament seemed to have lost both power and potential now that the party has moved towards more moderate stances. Max Civili, Rome.
Since the riots began in September, anti-Iran media has been depicting the situation as a violent crackdown on so-called peaceful protesters. For the past 2 months, they have been running a propaganda campaign to further pressure Iran under the pretext of violating human rights. But are these peaceful protesters? Iran's intelligence ministry has recently reported the confiscation of a huge cache of weapons and equipment used by terrorists. In fact, Iranian security forces have thwarted several arms smuggling operations and dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the terrorist organizations such as MKO. This comes as the illegal influx of weapons into the country is on the rise recently. The confiscated weapons were supposed to be transferred to Iran to be used in the recent riots. Last month, in an interview with the Persian service of the British state-funded broadcaster BBC, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said the, quote, Iranian opposition is now being armed with weapons. Bolton added that these arms are being smuggled into the country from the Iraq's Kurdistan region, praising the use of force against Iran's security forces. The recent foreign-backed riots in Iran have claimed hundreds of lives belonging to both security forces and ordinary people. In addition, by conducting acts of vandalism, violence, and insecurity, rioters have paved the way for separatist and terrorist groups to infiltrate the country and carry out brutal attacks against innocent people.
Smuggling huge amounts of weapons into Iran to be used in the recent foreign-backed unrest is merely aimed at undermining the country's security. But Iranian officials have time and again stated that Iran's security is a red line that no one is allowed to cross. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Lebanon has arrested 185 people suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency since October 2019, when the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis became apparent.
This is Israel's intelligence agency's invasion of the Lebanese virtual sovereignty. The Israelis took advantage of the economic crisis and the fact that the Lebanese are looking for job opportunities with US dollars coming from abroad. And so they created fake companies through which they acquired thousands of resumes from Lebanese people. They were able to contact any one of those job hunters in the guise of foreign companies, while in reality they were Israeli recruiters.
Lebanese security sources have told AFP that the number has increased dramatically, from only 4 or 5 arrests per year.
One of the most notable examples of this was the busting of over 35 Lebanese and Palestinians that were gathering intelligence on Hezbollah and of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon for Israel. Israel, again, used a lot of fake companies and front groups to trap those kind of in a desperate economic situation into accepting these fake front opportunities.
Out of the 185 people arrested since 2019, 165 have been prosecuted and 25 convicted and sentenced. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in several ways, but it seems it's not the only reason for treason. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their communications with the Mossad out of sheer opposition
to the resistance.
When we read the interrogation reports of those who were arrested, we understand that it was more than only giving intelligence. One of the suspects admits that he was asked to write articles aimed at sowing sedition amongst the Lebanese and inciting people against Hezbollah and resistance. They asked him, for example, to write articles which would give an impression that Hezbollah is linked to the Beirut port explosion in order to provoke hatred against the resistance movement.
Political analysts believe recruiting spies by the Israeli regime will continue since a military option is not on the table.
These kinds of more subtle forms of gaining influence in Lebanon, and especially putting people into a very desperate economic state and taking advantage of that, seems to both basically cut the losses on the military front that Israel and the U.S. Even know that it has unmatched against the resistance forces in the region.
Although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with Israel, there has been no direct confrontation between the two sides since 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities have never stopped. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The 18th International Muslim Forum has summed up celebrations of the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the Volga, Bulgaria. Many religious figures addressed the International Forum. Russian Mufti Sheikh Ravil Gaynuddin called for a just world order from the standpoint of the East. Chairman of the Turkish Department of Religious Affairs, Ali Erbaş, spoke about the connection between justice and security. Chief Justice of Palestine, Mahmoud Al-Habaş, accused Israel and the United States of violating international law. The main two words, justice and a new world order, became the leitmotif of the plenary session.
We have gathered here to raise the voice of justice and moderation, to exchange scientific opinions through dialogue. The Islamic State, the Muslims of Russia, all of us must stand together against the liberalism that they are trying to impose on us. This false world view is in fact engaged in the seizure of the world's material wealth and assets. Our joint cooperation should be directed against this upstart arrogance, despotism, and oppression of the liberal world. The Islamic principles of the world view are the values that the world could take as an example.
Back in 1881, the Russian Muslim thinker and educator Ismail B. Gasprinsky wrote that in the near future, quote, Russia will be destined to become one of the significant Muslim states, which will not in the least diminish its significance as a great Christian power. The participants of the forum are convinced that his dream is coming true today. Russian Muslims, hand in hand with their partners, are making a unique contribution to renewing the global discourse on justice. The rapprochement of the Islamic world with Russia and success in this matter is directly related to the openness of the Russian civilization to its Eastern heritage, including the spiritual tradition of Russian Muslims.
We are being imposed a globalist, neoliberal understanding of the modern world order. The imposition is very aggressive. They encroached on a family. Many have caved into these patterns of the new world order. The Islamic world, which reads the Quran and is charged with energy and the word of the Quran, is trying to resist and adjoin those centers that are able to challenge and protect humanity from destructive energy. Russia is the defender of the classical traditional order set forth in the sacred scriptures. Therefore, one must follow this path, not lose hope, not give up, because this is a Quranic instruction to unite and be a single organism, a single ummah.
The participants of the forum believe that the time has come to talk about a just world order not only from the standpoint of the West, but also from the East.
Russia is celebrating the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the people of Volga, Bulgaria, marking the importance of Islam in the country. This year is commemorated with the participation of representatives from dozens of Muslim countries during various events. The anniversary is also an opportunity for Russia to strengthen its ties with participating Muslim countries that have been isolated by the West. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The limelight.
The Zionist regime forces continue their attacks against Palestinians. What is disappointing is the inaction from world community and the so-called defenders of human rights. In this regard, we have provided views from world media websites. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada had this headline, writing, "Why are Israel's cops a strategic partner for EU?" This website noted, "Supporters of the Israeli regime, believe it or not, get one or two things right. The constant claim that their beloved regime cherishes innovation contains a grain of truth. What other oppressive views Facebook and Twitter as such vital tools for alerting the world to its brutality?" On October 8, the Zionist regime police force effectively admitted that it was subjugating civilians en masse. The force posted photographs on the internet of its officers helping to seal off Shafat's refugee camp near Al-Quds. The Zionist regime presented the suffocation of Shafat as a response to the killing of an Israeli troop. Collective punishment is forbidden under the Geneva Conventions and other instruments of international law. Every time it resorts to collective punishment, the Zionist regime commits a war crime. Avoiding democratic oversight, the European Union has built a formal alliance with the Zionist regime's police. The EU even signed an accord on deepening ties with Israeli regime's police during September, just a few weeks before that force implicitly boasted of committing a war crime in Shafat camp. Though that accord, the Zionist regime can exchange personal data about Palestinians living under occupation with Europol, the EU's police agency. The deal was put together quite swiftly by EU standards. Negotiations aimed at sealing it kicked off in November 2021. Around the same time that the talks opened, the Israeli regime sent a delegation of 30 high-ranking diplomats to Brussels. Among the many officials they met were Laurent Michel from the Migration and Home Affairs Department of the European Commission, the EU's executive. A briefing note prepared for Michel's discussions obtained under Freedom of Information rules states that Israel is a strategic partner country for the EU on security cooperation. The accord signed in September this year follows on from a 2018 working arrangement between the Israeli regime and Europol. The briefing note for Michel contends that there should be even stronger cooperation with the Zionist regime. It points out that Europol assists the national authorities of EU governments in identifying cross-border links to organized crime. The Israeli contribution in such cases continues to be of utmost importance, it adds. Since the 2018 arrangement entered into force, the Israeli regime has established a liaison office at Europol's headquarters in The Hague. Such steps offer considerable potential to promote operational contribution, the briefing note says. The 2018 arrangement gives a list of crimes on which the Zionist regime and Europol may work together. They include terrorism and war crimes. It stipulates, too, that information exchanged between the two sides must not be collected in obvious violation of human rights. Joke? Was that somebody's idea of a joke? The Zionist regime's police force, as already noted, actively commits war crimes while serving a state that labels all forms of resistance to its systematic violence as terrorism. The Zionist regime systematically uses torture against Palestinians in so-called terrorism investigations, methods which are officially sanctioned and carried out with impunity. The fact that the Zionist regime's police force is based in occupied East Al-Quds should be sufficient to rule out any dealing with it. Despite opposing the Zionist regime's colonization of East Al-Quds on paper, the EU has embraced a police force which plays an integral part in colonization.